Well, we had an excellent discourse on the formula for consecrated living, and now we're going to get some meat of the word from Brother John. And he has chosen as his subject the willful king. And there is a handout being in its two pages. So if you haven't received two pages, there are two pages to the handout. And I'm sure we're going to receive a rich blessing from Brother John's ministry. The willful king, Brother John.
Thank you, Brother Dan. Well, friends, we're very happy to be here with you. There are two handouts. There's one of quotes, and there's one that gives some scriptures related to the 1260 days. If you don't have those handouts, please raise your hand. I see some young ones coming along to share those with you. So there's two handouts, one of quotes and one of some texts on the 1260 days. Friends, first off, we bring you love from the brethren in Mahomet. They have both a standing order to send love and also vote every week to send love to everyone. And we're glad some of us are here. Thankful Sister Karen and Sister Isabel come along with me. Glad Brother Harry and Sister Karen are here too. And Brother Danny and Sister Judy McClugan wanted their special love sent as well. Well, friends, our subject is the willful king. And we're waiting a moment for our technology to get with the program. But you can see up here, this seemingly is about a very obscure part of history. Napoleon's campaign in Egypt. You might recognize Napoleon there taking a look at the Sphinx. Friends, we've been studying the time of the end in Muhammad. We really enjoy that. And this is a personally favorite subject of mine because I knew a lot of history as a kid. I always loved it. And when I was first studying the truth, one of the things that especially helped establish my faith was the third volume, because the scriptures recorded there give really the true understanding of history that, you know, we study in our textbooks, and particularly this time of the French Revolution and Napoleon as king. We're going to be taking a look at Daniel chapter 11. That's where this prophecy is primarily from. Also at Revelation 12. But we have to ask the question, why do the scriptures focus on this seemingly obscure piece of history? One of the most important dates in the scripture is marked by a battle in Egypt that most of us outside of the truth probably never heard of. But there are reasons, friends, and actually the historians today have been investigating this period of time much more because they see the roots of the modern conflict between the West and the Islamic world as really beginning at this time of Napoleon's campaign in Egypt. So, to rephrase the question a bit, why do the scriptures mark this time of the end by Napoleon's Egyptian campaign? Okay, let me try this one more time. Okay. Friends, pardon, my computer decided to reboot before I started it, maybe just a little bit, because it is very slow when it reboots. So, we'll go ahead and get started. Friends, we'd like to turn to Daniel chapter 11. We're going to start with verse 36. And if the Lord provides, we'll catch up with the pictures as time provides. Daniel chapter 11, we'll start with verse 36. Dear friends, I like to think of Daniel chapter 11 as especially showing what we call the stately steppings of our God in history. You know, friends, one of the things about the true Christianity is that in the Bible there are such things as chronology, time prophecy, things that show the foreknowledge of God, things that we look back on and find especially encouraging to our faith. Now, that is not typical of religions generally, and it's not typical really of nominal Christianity. They don't understand the meaning of these prophecies, but these were given especially for the church, sure. Were given especially for the church to be encouraged and built up. The time of the end is very critical in prophecy because it is the time when various prophecies in Daniel, the whole book of Daniel, would be opened up. So Daniel 11, verse 36. And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that which is determined is done. Now, friends, we call this subject the willful king because it says here, the king shall do according to his will. And if you study the history behind Napoleon, you find he is one of the most willful people, he's the most willful I have ever read about when you think of the things that he undertook. And we'll get into some of that as we go. This description really fits him to a T. Speaking marvelous things against the God of gods, that's a reference to the Pope. You know, friends, the time in history of the French Revolution and the period came after it was such a tumultuous period. It took mankind quite a while to really understand what those events, what the true meaning of it was. And in this verse, the speaking against the God of gods, it is very difficult for us to understand that aspect of history without understanding the kind of life the common person had in the Middle Ages. You know, we often talk about the divine right of kings, the divine right of the clergy. There's also the third one we don't often remember as well, but it's basically the divine right to be a peasant. That you were what you were because that was God's will and everyone accepted it. And if you think about that kind of life where individuals lived basically within a mile or two of their home, they never traveled any further than that. The only people they knew were those in their own village. They had land that had been given to them generation after generation, land that had to stay in the family because that was the source of their livelihood. I remember one of my professors talking about, thank you, you know, friends, out with the old, in with the new. But I remember my history professor talking about how important it was that the peasants of old knew what land belonged to them, that every property had its landmarks that were to be remembered in that family. And you had to know whether your neighbor tried to move your landmark that marked out your territory. So what the parents would do when the children were of a certain age, they would take them out to the field and they would basically beat them. They would beat the recognition of that part of the land into the child's mind so they would never allow their landmark to be moved. They would never lose that land. Friends, it is such a different way of thinking. Today, you know, we have so many benefits that we take for granted that really come out of, that start with this period of time. Okay, thank you very much. So here you have, go back to verse 36, the king shall do according to his will, he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god. And friends, we wanted to just note for you, we gave you some of the quotes because some of them are just so helpful. I've got it and you don't. As they say, it helps to look out the window. In your handout, friends, if you would go to number 2 under Napoleon Egypt, I just wanted to give you some idea of his willfulness and how he would exalt himself. Now, the directory here was the government of France after the revolution, after the Reign of Terror. The directory was under the impression that Napoleon intended to invade Egypt. Napoleon harbored dreams of following in the footsteps of Alexander the Great and marching all the way to India. When he revealed to the directory this extension to his plans, they reluctantly assented. They didn't believe it. This was merely the fantasy of a man intoxicated by ambition. If there's one thing the contemporaries talk about Napoleon, it is that tremendous ambition. He dreamed. Now, friends, think about this. This is right after the French Revolution. It's after the overturning of society in France. Napoleon was really from a very minor noble family. To have a dream to be like Alexander the Great and also like Julius Caesar, we'll see in a moment. Here Napoleon is, if you take a look at that first quote, he thinks nothing of organizing the French fleet to go off on an expedition 2,000 miles away from France. This is at the end, friends, of the Middle Ages, you might. Well, it's a little bit after that. But anyway, it was the greatest seaborne invasion of that time. Now, friends, I have trouble sometimes organizing myself for the day, let alone a fleet, to go off to Egypt to conquer. He is full of this willfulness and ambition. Let me jump down to verse 7. Here's one thing that he said to the sheiks when he got to Egypt. He promised to strike my enemies like fire from heaven. It is best for you to understand that all human efforts against me are useless because all that I undertake is bound to succeed. Now, friends, this is before he's conquered Europe that he says this. And the Lord knew just the right kind of character to use in this period of history. Okay. Now, in verse 36, it speaks there again also about the God of gods and prospering till the indignation be accomplished for what the Lord determined would be done. Napoleon actually conquered the Papal States in 1797. He conquered there early before the Pope was taken prisoner in 1798 and before this Egyptian campaign. Basically, the Lord allowed him a little success, so he came to the attention of the French government enough that he could fulfill this later part of history. Now, Napoleon is really interesting because at that point, the Directory tells him, just take down the Pope. You know, it was a period of time, it was very possible that the Catholic Church could have lost its head. And Napoleon chose not to do that. We believe he chose not to do that because he saw the excesses of the French Revolution. He wasn't interested in the kind of anarchy that went with the French Revolution. He was interested in stable society. And he saw the Catholic Church, as we'll see later, as part of basically controlling society, uniting it. He must have had dreams at this point even of uniting it under himself. Is he doesn't take action against the Pope at that point. His goal is really to subordinate the church to the state. And friends, we like this phrase in verse 36, prosper till the indignation be accomplished. He had basically 18 years of experience dealing with the papacy. We focus on 1798 and 1799 with the Pope being taken prisoner, the Pope then dying in captivity. But basically, Napoleon degraded the Pope for 18 years. There's a real history of that that we might touch on as we go. He also took the Pope that you don't see up here is the one that died in captivity. There's another Pope that he took into captivity for 6 years who was only liberated when Napoleon was defeated in 1814, his first defeat. Okay, let's go on to verse 37. Okay, in verse 37, neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. You know, friends, Napoleon exalted himself. That is very true. You all might be familiar with the famous picture of him anointing or crowning Josephine, his queen, with the Pope in attendance. Napoleon's known for crowning himself, using his own authority to crown the queen. He wanted the popes there for the trappings of their agreement, but under no circumstances was there to be in any way shown that his authority was somehow derived from the Catholic Church. And we'd like to read about this point about exalting himself, friends. If you could go to quote number 6. We found this really interesting, another observer of his. By his own confessions, Napoleon's ultimate objectives were not always clear to himself. In the last analysis, it was his destiny that seemed to matter most. All my life, he wrote, I have sacrificed everything. Comfort, self-interest, happiness, to my destiny. That was his attitude. Exalted by his successes, he identified or confused that destiny with the destiny of civilization itself. He thought huge, friends, just huge. As Mademoiselle de Stael observed, he wanted to put his gigantic self, we might add all 5'2" of him, in the place of mankind. He thought whatever was good for Napoleon was good for mankind. We'd like to jump down, friends, then to, because we're going to get into his trip to Egypt. If you go down to number 10 and 11, this is very interesting. Napoleon had an entire plan for going to Egypt, and his purpose was not just to conquer. he wanted to establish basically a new civilization. And he had all these plans ahead of time of what he was going to do. And these quotes will tell you a little bit about it. The first one there, he had written a proclamation to the Egyptians. He had a problem, though. Egyptians spoke Arabic. How does he get this translated and put all over, you know, the Turkish Empire at that point? Because he wanted this message to go of friendliness to the Turks. Here's what he writes. In the name of Allah the Merciful, people of Egypt, you will have been told that I come as an enemy of Islam. This is a lie. I have come to restore your rights and punish those who oppress you. I worship God more than your oppressors. Now, friends, think about that. This is after the French Revolution. After they've thrown out religion in France, he has the nerve to say, I worship God more than your fathers do. I respect Muhammad and his prophet and the Holy Quran. The French, the atheistic French at this point, are also true Muslims. The proof of this can be seen in the fact that they have marched against Rome and destroyed the throne of the Pope, who constantly incited the Christians to make war on all Muslims. There's one of those great indignities he spoke against the Pope. Muslims, I'm on your side. You can tell because I took care of the Pope in Italy. It was really under his direction that the general who took the Pope prisoner, Napoleon had a hand in that, is what I'm trying to say. Well, verse 11 gives you a little more background, brethren. There's a real irony in this when you catch this. Prior to arrival, this proclamation would be translated into Arabic by one of the Orientalists amongst the savants and printed on the Arabic printing press, which Napoleon was carrying on board. He found an Arabic printing press. Where did he get it? He scoured Europe for an Arabic printing press. Ironically, the only one he managed to find was at the Papal Propaganda Office in Rome. So you get the picture here, friends. He writes a proclamation to the Muslims saying, you know, he's on their side because he's against the Pope, and he uses the Pope's own printing press. That's a perfect piece of irony here. Now look how big the ambition here is again. Napoleon described his feelings at this time. I saw the way to achieve all my dreams. I would found a religion. I saw myself marching to Asia, mounted on an elephant, a turban on my head, and in my hand a new Quran that I would have composed to suit my needs. In my enterprises, I would have combined the experiences of two worlds, exploring the realm of all history for my own profit. I missed a part. Mounted on an elephant, a turban on my head, and in my hand. No, I did read that, sorry. You know, brethren, Napoleon thought he was just going to conquer Egypt. He was going to start a new civilization. He was going to be the new Alexander. You know, if the French weren't as cooperative as he hoped, I mean, he'd seen the French Revolution, how everyone was for himself at that point. He'd just start over in Egypt, and he would retake Alexander's empire. That's the kind of grandiose thinking that he had. That's the kind of character the Lord needed to use against papacy. And there are multiple reasons, friends, we hope that you'll see as we go through here. Okay, let's go on to verse 38. There's a very interesting point here as well in this description that's not so important to us, but it really fixes again that this is about Napoleon. But in his estate shall he honor the god of fortresses, and a god whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. Friends, Napoleon was known and just beloved by the army. You know, brethren, one of the things that the French Revolution changed that Napoleon took advantage of, today we call it total war. You know, if you think back to the medieval times and you're familiar with, you know, chivalry, the notion of chivalry and jousting and the knight in shining armor and all of that, war had rules. War was basically the playground for the nobles, and there were rules to fight by. It was supposed to be gentlemanly war, if there is such a thing. The French Revolution comes along, brethren, and it becomes total war. The French overthrow, you know, the king, they overthrow the church. They're fighting for liberty for everyone. And when the other kings try to put down the excesses of the French Revolution, the whole society mobilizes to fight. And so the Germans come and the Austrians come with their nice knights and their, you know, and they're not ready for this warfare that is total and all out. And brethren, you think about this, it's kind of amazing, this whole period of history, because if you think about that spirit of the French Revolution, what do you do in an army where it's liberty, equality, fraternity? Who obeys the captain's orders? How does that work? You know, you really need to be able to inspire by leadership, and that's what Napoleon did. And he was beloved by his soldiers. He is known for speeches where he basically says, like at the pyramids, he tells them, the history of 50 centuries looked down upon you. Come, take your glory. He tells them when they attack in Italy, you know, they hadn't eaten. He tells them the truth. They hadn't really eaten well in 2 months. Let's go get a victory and then enjoy the spoils of war. And that's what his armies did. They really funded their wars through their conquests. So they had tremendous incentive. When he took over the army, it didn't look very well. Starving, you know, not well equipped, and yet they won. Friend. So he was beloved by his soldiers. And he always shared, you know, Napoleon magnified himself, but he loved the fellow soldiers. He was very much at home with them. And so this honoring the God of forces, it's very clear the military leader he was, the way he dealt with his army and handled it, that was really what he was about. He wasn't about any kind of religion. Okay. Let's go on to verse 40 then. Here is where we get to really the heart of the point here. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter in the countries and shall overflow and pass through. So friends, how is Napoleon connected to the time of the end? The scriptures give the characteristics, brethren, we believe only fit him in time. But then we have a specific episode in history mentioned here. And verse 40 is really amazing, because what the Lord has done, if you've studied your time of the end chapter, this is very clear. We won't have time to go over it, but as you go through the early parts of the chapter, there's this continual conflict between the king of the north and the king of the south. The king of the north does this, the king of the south does that, and they go back and forth and back and forth. And if you really like history, brethren, there's a whole bunch of antiquity you can go into with that. That's really not important to our understanding. The real reason that is there is to point out there will come another period of time when an episode like what happened in ancient days will occur. And friends, this is very unique in medieval and modern history, because basically, though in ancient times you had the king of the north fighting the king of the south, when I see you look up, I guess that's a sign. But when you have this pattern taking place, it does not happen during the Middle Ages. It does not happen really from the time Julius Caesar conquers Egypt. You know, the issue with Cleopatra. Really, nothing happens until, in this King of the North, King of the South picture, until Napoleon brings this fleet against Egypt. Okay, let me pick up here, friends. And you know, Sister Mildred Raffel used to tell me she thought the adversary had to do especially with PA systems and anything electrical, you know. That may be. Okay, the king of the north and the king of the south. What I wanted to mention, friends, just real quick, if you look in Daniel chapter 11, something else that's very interesting, there are two other willful kings mentioned in this context. If you go to verse 3, a mighty king shall stand up and shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. Now, that is Alexander the Great. When you look at the context, this is about Greece, and it tells about how his empire is broken into four parts. And out of those four parts come this king of the north, king of the south deal that I've been mentioning. So one of Napoleon's heroes is even mentioned right here, one that he wants to be like. We think that's significant. If you jump down to verse 16... time has gone on. We believe verse 16 is referring to Julius Caesar. He that cometh against him shall do according to his own will. Again, none shall stand before him. He shall stand in a glorious land, which I think this is a poor translation, by which his hand shall be consumed. It's really the idea is that Palestine would be completely in Julius Caesar's control. Basically, he consolidated the power in the Roman Empire. Shall we try one more time? Okay. This, brethren, just I'm going to jump back just a little bit. I want to test this and see. Oh, okay. I'm sorry, friends. You're going to have to try to look over here to my left. I just want to show you, here's the picture of Napoleon crowning Josephine. This is one of the most famous paintings of the period. You see the Pope sitting behind him. You see all the bishops lined up. Napoleon was wonderful also at propaganda. He loved paintings like this that showed his authority and everybody looking at him and so forth. Oops. This is the Pope that died in 1799. Another famous propaganda piece of Napoleon. You'll often see him on a horse because he was so short, or the paintings, you know, make up for that. Okay, now I'll get back in the flow of things. This is a picture of he with his army. You can see how they basically adored him. Another propaganda piece to, again, cement the loyalty, but they really did love him. Okay, in verse 40, the time of the end, the king of the south shall push at him. Now, there are two kings involved, and this is interesting, brethren, because Napoleon is actually the third element in this discussion. In the past, the king of the south and the king of the north are fighting each other. In this context, the king of the north and south are both fighting against this willful king. So it's a little bit of a different point here. And the king of the south, brethren, is basically the Egyptians. We might add the Turks in here because they were nominally the overlords at that time. But we would connect, out of the king of the south, the chariots and the horsemen. The rulers of Egypt at that time were called the Mamluks, and they were very much feared as one of the greatest horse civilizations of that time. They, at that point, were thought to be unconquerable. They had survived for 400 or 500 years and basically had conquered all with their horsemanship. So we're not really familiar with them, but I think the scriptures pick up on a culture that really fits this point. Now, the king of the north rush upon him like a whirlwind with many ships. Friends, probably the greatest navy of all time is the British Navy. And the British were especially opposed to the French Revolution. And they became especially opposed to Napoleon. So what happens in 1799, Napoleon takes his fleet. He has an opening. He takes this fleet he prepares. He lands in Egypt. And it precipitates the king of the south and the king of the north to come against him. The British fleet actually lose track of him. It's one of the few times the British fleet made an error. They didn't know where Napoleon was going. They thought maybe he was headed for England to... English had no army, basically take the country. So they protected the western seas as opposed to the eastern seas where Napoleon had to go for Egypt. And if you take a look at your handout again, this is really interesting because I think the Lord just opened the window for this whole episode to take place. This is quote number 5. The Battle of the Nile, and that's the picture we have up here, was one of the most crushing naval victories of all times. On May 1st, the Mediterranean had been a French lake with no British warships sailing east of Gibraltar. On August 7th, the Royal Navy had complete mastery. So the British Navy finally finds Napoleon in, of all places, Egypt. It took them a few months to find him, and they destroy the French fleet. Napoleon's gotten off. His army has gotten off. All their scientific instruments they took, we'll mention that in a moment. So we think, brethren, this point of 1798, 1799, when Napoleon invades, is very well marked in history. And Napoleon comes in May of 1798, but we believe the point of 1799 is when the King of the South and the King of the North first really begin to work together against Napoleon. But that is what marks that particular date and time. And that isn't until, as I mentioned, 1799. Okay. Napoleon and his army at this point are cut off from France, so what does the willful king do? And we'd like to ask just at this point, why this Egyptian campaign? This seems pretty crazy. Why didn't the French just stay home and, you know, it's a great ambition? Well, Napoleon had the idea not only of creating this new empire for himself. The French thought it would be a blow against the British because the British had far-flung colonies all over, and this would threaten their hold on India in particular. And the directorate also, seeing how ambitious Napoleon was, wanted to get him out of the way. What better to do than send him off to Egypt, never dreaming he was going to come back a conquering hero. So the time of the end, brethren, we're going to pose has worldwide implications, not just upon Christendom. We think that the Lord was giving us a hint about that in this episode. It's very interesting. Egypt was one of the most backward countries at that time. You know, you may have read about ancient times when they didn't know about basic sanitation, and they throw their garbage and their refuse and everything in the streets. In Egypt, they just wait for the Nile once a year to clear everything out. It was a very, very ugly society. And friends, we don't often talk about this, but the Arabians had given up even using the wheel. You know, when Napoleon came, here he comes with his carts and everything, and you look around Egypt, there are no carts. There's nothing with wheels. Well, friends, that society found that if you had a mobile asset, something that could be taken very easily on wheels, it would be gone. So they gave up the wheel. You remember what was said about Ishmael, about his hand would be against his brother? That seems to be a very fitting point. So in the decline of their civilization, they even gave up the wheel. So Napoleon comes on this situation. We'll see what he desired to do. Another important point that the historians say that Egypt was part of the Muslim heartland. The Muslim heartland had not been invaded up to this point after Muhammad had taken control. Never been conquered by non-Muslims. This was a tremendous shock to the Islamic mind. Now, Napoleon comes, and this reminds us, brethren, of recent goals you hear administrations talk about in the world today. His goal in Egypt was to free them from tyranny, show them the light of reason, provide the advantages of popular government, instruct them in the latest scientific advances. I won't read them, but there's quotes 3 and 4 on your handout. Brethren, we think this is a very appropriate beginning for the time of the end. You take the most backward society, you take someone coming in thinking, we're going to give them every advantage of society and civilization today. He was going to remold it. He even starts the Institute of Egypt, basically higher education in a society that has no wheel. That's the contrast, friends. He brings along with him 170 of the wisest men in France. They bring the latest scientific instruments. They're going to study the country. You know, brethren, the time of the end was to be about men running to and fro and knowledge being increased. How appropriate is, this is a journey of 2,000 miles, and they go there to learn everything they can. Isn't it fitting how that time would start? Now, in verse 29, we find another explanation of the king of the north and the king of the south. If we would go back there, we'll read verse 29 and 30. At the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. For the ships of Kittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant, and so forth. Well, friends, what we find here is that Napoleon, this willful king, he comes similarly to the way that other willful kings have come, Alexander and Julius Caesar, but he doesn't control Egypt for long. He's only there about a year, and his army eventually has to give it up and leave. Their army's destroyed. They have to make peace and get out basically ignominiously in the end. We believe there's a real consistency here in the spirit of those in this picture who came against Egypt. And we find that embodied in Napoleon, whose two heroes were Alexander and Julius Caesar. Now, what does Napoleon do? His army is intact. His navy is destroyed. He can't get back home. He advances against other countries. He hears the Turks are out to get him, so he takes his army to meet him and conquers. He eventually gets stopped, and he has to return to France. But wherever he goes, he basically conquers. The scriptures note that he enters the glorious land. This is verse 41 and 44. I'll just jump back to. Tidings out of the east and the north trouble him. Napoleon hears that there's a new coalition back in Europe against the French. So he returns, and he returns with great fury to destroy and to utterly make away many. You know, friends, Napoleon has not conquered Europe yet. He goes home to France. He makes himself the dictator, and he goes out and he conquers everyone but England. He wins battle after battle. They're not prepared for him. The Lord wants him to continue until that indignation against Catholicism is finished. Now, friends, we have to interpose here. If you jump back to Daniel chapter 12, and we will hustle. In Daniel chapter 12, there is a reference to the French Revolution. We're going to read verses 5 through 7. This is Daniel 12, 5 through 7. Daniel 12, 5 through 7. We don't want to forget that in the book of Daniel, the time of the end prophecy includes both chapter 12 and chapter 11. Michael standing up in verse 1 is part of the time of the end prophecy. And really, in chapter 12, verses 1 through 4 give you the highlight that Daniel's been waiting for. The one who is like God, Michael, will stand up for his people. Everything after verse 4 is really explanation given, background that's really, again, for us to appreciate. In verse 5, Daniel then sees another vision, and he sees that there are two standing on each side of a river, and the idea here is a flooded river. And in verse 6, one asks, the thought really is that they both ask the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters, that's important, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? And I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left unto heaven, that when he shall have accomplished the breaking up of the power of the holy people, all these things shall be accomplished. Well, I missed the important part. It would be for a time, times, and a half. That's a reference to 1260 days. There are two things here tied together, brethren. The time of the end, that this discussion really is all about establishing when that would occur, and the fact that it would be the end of something, of a 1260-day period of persecution against the church. That flood that you read about is a reference to the French Revolution, that flood would have something to do with the end of the 1260 days. Friends, we believe here in this context that the man dressed in linen is a reference to Brother Russell. Now, he was not alive in the time of the French Revolution, but we think it's significant that he was above the waters. He was not touched by those waters. But the understanding of this period of time and the prophecies of the 1260, 1290, and 1335 that go on in this chapter, he's the one that put together that understanding and shared with the church. Others came up with parts of it, but the one that made it clear for the church was the man in linen. That's how we understand it. We know there may be other thoughts. Now, the question includes, what are these wonders? And really, these wonders are the things that made Daniel sick in all the visions that he saw. Now, the abomination that makes desolate, the one that practiced and prospered, cast the truth to the ground. The little horn that came up on the beast that had the eyes and the mouth speaking great things. It's also referred to as the fierce king in the book of Daniel. Daniel could understand blessings coming to the Lord's people, but how could you understand this apostasy that the Lord allowed for so long to persecute the Lord's people? That's what they were wondering about. And this flood, we'll see, has to do with a bringing to the end of that arrangement. Now, Revelation chapter 12, verse 15 and 16. You know, brethren, it's very interesting that the French Revolution is prominent not only in the book of Daniel, but also in Revelation. In verse 15 and 16, we find a very unusual scripture. The serpent casts out of his mouth water like a flood after the woman. The woman here represents the church, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. And the earth helps the woman. The earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. Friends, what we have here basically is a masterstroke by the serpent, the adversary, who wants to destroy the church. Persecution has not done it throughout the period of papal dominance. So he switches tactics. He thinks, I will send out truth that is so strong that people won't want to hear it. They won't want anything to do with it. It will be such an upsetting of society that they'll reject it. They'll reject the Bible along with it. The church will not have anything to sustain it. That's what this picture is really about, friends. Okay. Oops. So, friends, this casting out of the truth is really the message of the French Revolution. Now, you take what I mentioned earlier about the lives of the peasant, and to send forth ideas like liberty, equality, fraternity. Friends, the idea that men are free, that they're equal, that the distinctions between clergy and nobles and peasants are a lie and are to be done away with. And friends, this fraternity is really, you might say, the idea of patriotism, nationalism. How were the French able to hold together when all the other countries came against them? It was really because of the fraternity, the brotherhood they felt as a nation. Those were things that were not part of the Middle Ages. Friends, this is a picture of the storming of the Bastille. You know, friends, this history period, do you know how they told the difference between the peasants and the clergy and the kings? It's very simple. Just shake your hand. If you felt my hand, you'd realize I wasn't a worker. My hand's soft. But if you felt the calluses and the roughness of the hand, they knew you were truly a worker. And they executed people just on that basis in the French Revolution. It was such a radical change. Now, friends, there's an interesting point also in Revelation 11. We're going to go to just mention verse 2 and verse 7. Revelation 11 mentions the 1260 years as a period when the Bible, the two witnesses, would prophesy in sackcloth. It's a period when you might say the scriptures in one sense were set aside, but it's really a picture that shows the dearth or the lack of water of truth during that period of time. The scriptures were locked up. They prophesied in sackcloth and ashes of the better times that were to come. But in verse 7, it mentions that when the two witnesses finish their testimony, there is a beast that ascends from the abyss and makes war and conquers and kills the two witnesses. Now, that's kind of hard to understand. How is the Bible killed? Well, friends, this flood of truth that went out in the French Revolution was so radical, and Napoleon's, we might say good use of the Pope, others might say misuse of the Pope, called into question religion and the Bible generally. That's what the point is here. It seemed as if the era of religion and the Bible was over. And not only did the French Revolution take place, but here's a ruler conquering everyone right and left who's not espousing religion. Now, we believe this is an important point, brethren, because this beast that ascends out of the abyss, we believe, represents anarchy. That overturning of society was so violent that it's represented by something that is unthinkable, something that is hidden down in the abyss. It's important to note Napoleon is forged by the French Revolution. I've already gone over the French Revolution de-Christianized France. One of the amazing things about this willful king, brethren, is that how do you take this wild beast from the abyss that has overturned society and do anything with it? And we call this the willful king tames the wild beast. And I just put a chronology up here of the French Revolution. 1789, you've got the Reign of Terror in the early 90s. The Directory is the government that comes in place. It's pretty shaky because the French don't want to be ruled after the Revolution. Napoleon conquers Italy. We've mentioned the Papal States. He's in Egypt. He comes back in 1799. He has made himself so wildly popular with the army and with the people. He's viewed as the savior of France at this point, that he's able to make himself the dictator. And 5 years later, this nation that guillotined the king and queen accept a new emperor. So they go from liberty, equality, fraternity to accepting another emperor. Now, Napoleon actually was pretty good on the equality and the fraternity part. You might say, you know, he treated everybody badly. He certainly did all the kings, but he did believe in equality in society, and he believed in fraternity. He was not very good on liberty, friends, and which we find appropriate because this is before 1874 and the cry of liberty to the people. There are many very interesting things on religion. We'll just put the quote here. Napoleon's principle is to look upon religion as the work of man, but to respect it everywhere as a powerful means of government. He signs a concordat with the Pope basically because he wants society to be stable. The French still had elements that were pushing Catholicism that weren't going to be satisfied until there was some kind of restoration of the church. Napoleon does that, but he makes it very clear that the church is subordinate to himself. Verse 36 again in Daniel 11, he prospers till the indignation is accomplished. He makes himself emperor. Some historians say the last 10 years of his rule were basically pretty flawed because the soldiers don't fight quite as enthusiastically for an emperor as they did for Napoleon before that. Now, the last picture down there is a picture of the Pope that he held for 6 years, who's finally liberated in 1814. That Pope had the nerve to excommunicate Napoleon, so Napoleon made him a house guest for 6 years. We love this scripture, brethren, verse 45, the last one in this chapter, refers again to the glorious holy mountain in this place. It's a reference to Palestine. He shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. This is a picture of Napoleon on the Isle of St. Helena. When he was at last defeated in 1815, he's taken to the most remote, inhospitable place just about you could find because he has been so dangerous, this willful king. And we love this, brethren, because there's a reference here to Palestine. Whatever Napoleon's designs were about having an empire and whatever role he thought Palestine would play in that, it wasn't the Lord's time. It wasn't the Lord's permission. He had a work for Napoleon to do, which was really finishing the work of the Reformation, completely eliminating the superstition toward the Pope, but not anything with regard to Israel. In your handout, friends, there is a wonderful quote you have to mention here. It's on the second page at the top. It's number 12. Napoleon is also the very first person to tell the Jews in modern times that the land belongs to them. And he even convenes a Sanhedrin. And he believes in equality to the point that his armies, as they go around Europe, knock the walls of the ghettos down. And there's some kind of humorous stories about what the Jews in the ghettos thought when Napoleon's armies came with great fanfare, fireworks going off, and the people singing and rejoicing, knocking the walls of the ghettos down. Yep, we will hustle ahead. And friends, the real answer we know is in chapter 12. The one who would restore Daniel's people is not Napoleon, but our beloved Messiah. Friends, just real quick, Revelation 17 mentions the wild beast again, the one that ascends from the pit. We think this is very significant personally because it says to our minds that a condition like the French Revolution would return and that the work begun by Napoleon of destroying the Catholic Church, Daniel 7:26 mentions the judgment would sit. There would be a period of time and a period of consumption before it would be finally destroyed. And there's a lot that could be said about that. The people are amazed. You know, friends, we live in such wonderful conditions with restitution, blessings, and materialism, wealth, and so forth, according to the flesh. So it's hard to even think that this would happen. I think that's partly mentioned in Revelation 17. And this is what's referred to as the eighth condition of the beast. We don't believe that's something that we have seen. Can't say more about that at this point, friends. Real quick, impact of Napoleon. He took the French Revolution ideas all over Europe. He took it through the heartland of the Reformation, friends. He really finished the work there. He defeated the old and new Austria. And some of this is in the very last quote, friends, if you want to reference this. Those who claim to be the successors of Rome defeated both of them. He ended the Holy Roman Empire. He conquered a European realm bigger than any of the other great conquerors of the past. He created more kings in a year and a half, mostly from his family, of course, than the Holy Roman Empire had in a millennium. He emancipated the Jews. He sold the Louisiana colony to the United States. Friends, we think that's really important because when the harvest time would come, the Lord basically prepared a place in the United States for the harvest work to start and to be ministered worldwide. And he brought people from all over the world. They needed a place to be. This was a part of the setting the stage for that. And he ended for us papal dominion and the power to persecute. The highest thing for the church, of course, is this. Many benefits for mankind, but for the church to have the freedom to really understand the scriptures, to be ready for the harvest truths that were coming. So again, why Napoleon's Egyptian campaign? You know, even Arab scholars see modern history begins there. They look at Napoleon as just the leader who first brought war to Islam. They're not really interested in modernization, basically, as a society. And that's exactly what he tried to do, and really the West has tried to do ever since. He emancipated both Christians and Jews. This is something else they hate. They were top dog. He treated the Christians and Jews in Egypt just, you know, as good as the Muslims. So he impacted really not only Christianity, but also Judaism and Islam. Now, friends, it's interesting, the three Abrahamic religions. Seems like this was a preparation, brethren, for the Muslim world also for the kingdom. The time of the end is also called the Naam, the day of his preparation. And we think both for the church and the world, the Lord used this willful king to do that. May the Lord add his blessing.